topic today is inflation. And what I think I'll do today, because in the past I've tried to provide some framework so that having looked at the framework, we could do some or carry on some discussion. Today I think I'm going to try and let you guide me through the session, and I'll just ask the leading questions and then do some summaries of some of the things that you've said. So I have several questions on the board. They're not designed for you to be able to read them. It's just for myself to know where I am at certain times, because I'm going to need the rest of the board to do a few things. So I'll run through those right now, and then I'll repeat them as we reach each one. But to give you an overview, first of all, the basic question of what is inflation? The second question, is there anything wrong with inflation? Really, is there anything wrong with it? The third one, what are the causes of inflation? That may be the single most confusing factor. People give all kinds of reasons for inflation. What really is the cause? Then, why do inflation and unemployment seem to be going up over time? Do they move up simultaneously? What is causing the unemployment rate to gradually go up and inflation? Why is it so difficult to solve inflation? I'm going to try and show you what some of the causes are when I summarize that section, and you would think it wouldn't be too difficult to solve inflation. But why is it such a complex matter? And we'll do a little examination of the history of inflation since the Vietnam War. And then finally, some solutions, different alternatives we could try to solve the inflation problem. And I'd like to say something at the very end about a Christian perspective that we could take as we look at those solutions. Well, to begin with, what is inflation? Just a real general definition, very basic. Anybody?
It takes more to buy less.
The average price level of goods go up, so that because of that, $1 will not buy as much. The purchasing power of the dollar falls. Okay. It's interesting to note that it's an average concept. The price level goes up by 10% a year. That does not mean that all prices go up by 10%. Some may go up by 20%. Some may only go up by 3%. And in the case of agriculture, we often find in different situations, the price will actually fall while there's inflation. So it's an average concept. And when we use a consumer price index, what they do is they take a typical basket of goods that are bought by secretaries and I forget what. It's a real old index. And they just see what they generally buy, and then they monitor those 400 goods to see what happens to prices. So at one time it was thought to be a good indicator of inflation. I suppose you could debate that somewhat now, but we have wholesale price index. There are a number of things that we can look at. What is wrong with inflation? I'll give you an example. If my income goes up by 10% a year because inflation is going up by 10% a year, so what? I mean, what's really wrong with inflation? I mean, why should we even care about it? Inflation was 10-12% last year, so the faculty at Luther all said we want a 10-12% increase. I think we're going to get it. So why should anybody be worrying about inflation? What are the real problems of inflation? Sometimes we just imagine there are problems. Or is there really a problem? Anybody want to give that a try?
Yeah, it's not a problem if you borrowed money.
Okay, Al?
It's not a problem if you borrow a lot of money.
Okay. I'll put two categories here. Who is going to benefit from inflation? And who is hurt by inflation? Okay, if you borrow, I tell students nowadays, this is good advice for the individual, terrible advice for the country. I say to students, borrow money. My goodness, you can borrow on these government loans at very low interest. And by the time you pay them back, 3, 4, 5 years later, the dollars you pay back may only buy about 60-70% of what the dollars bought that you borrowed. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to borrow money, because the money. In fact, if I could sit down and work through the numbers, we have house payments in the area of about $300 a month. At the rate of inflation of 10% a year, my last house payment, 25 years from now, will buy 2 tickets to a movie. at about $5-6 because of inflation. So it seems like it's bothering me now to pay $300 a month. But if inflation continues, look how I've gained from borrowing. I make my final payment, which buys $300 of housing today, it'll buy two tickets to a movie based on today's prices. So right, if you borrow, that can be a good thing in inflation. Okay. On the other hand, who gets hurt? Those who are lending the money. The lenders. Now, they're trying to increase their interest rates to cover inflation. But they are going to be hurt to some extent by that. Okay. Others who are hurt or who benefit?
Fixed income.
Okay. If you're on a fixed income, you're going to be hurt because you get the same amount of money each month, but the purchasing power falls. Or if someone who's retired has savings set aside and they're fixed, as you keep drawing on those savings, the purchasing power falls. Those who benefit are those who have flexible incomes, and it's greater than the rate of inflation. I mean, if we think that inflation is hurting people in the United States, there are a lot of people who are making a lot of money off of inflation. Great gains from this. I'll give you another little example. We aren't able to afford to buy a house on my salary. So what we do is build parts of our houses. We have the contractors put up the frame, but we do a lot of our own work. I would guess that in 5 years, I have now $40,000 in a house. My house is worth $40,000 more than I paid for it. In 5 years, I've earned $40,000, mainly because of inflation. And think of that. Well, why should I complain about inflation? Boy, I'm getting rich. I think about selling that house, have $40,000, going out a ways and building some kind of a log cabin, and being self-sufficient. Look what inflation did for me. Okay, anybody else who benefited or is hurt?
The government. In the tax structure.
Well, I'd say the government benefits then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, government benefits because of the tax structure.
Because you move to a higher, tax
percentage.
Bracket.
Benefit because they're a borrower too.
Oh yes.
You got a national debt that's
mm-hmm. Okay, so
that'll be paying off in movie right. Tickets.
Okay. Let's see. Are there any others?
Savers.
Good. Okay. If you save money, I tell students, if you've got some extra money, put it in the bank and make 7% a year, because they don't have enough money to buy these CDs or whatever that have high interest. So you've earned 7% this year. At the end of the year, you take your money out and you go to buy whatever it was you were saving for, and the price went up 10-12%. Oh, you've really made a good decision there. Well, if you couldn't buy it, at least you're no further behind. I mean, you've gained 7% as opposed to nothing. But there's not much incentive to save. On the other hand, people who speculate, I probably should have put myself down here as a speculator in the housing market. I probably had myself in the wrong category because I was talking about incomes up here. As a speculator, if you speculate in the right areas, land prices are going up faster than the average inflation level. You put your money in a housing, apartments, and a real estate. You put your money in, at one time, gold, silver. What else can you invest in? Oh, baseball cards. My mother gave away almost a couple $1,000 worth of my baseball cards, but didn't tell me for about 8 years. I thought they were in a box somewhere. Well, speculating, that was not necessarily intentional at the time, but you can speculate in areas and make a lot of money off of inflation. Okay. What then is the major problem with inflation? Some are hurt, but you look at those who are hurt, they're trying to do something about savings accounts. They're trying to get interest rates up to encourage savings. The people who have fixed incomes, Social Security, for example, has a cost of living allowance. More and more people now are trying to ensure that they do not get hurt by inflation. So this factor, the flexible versus fixed income, is not as great as it used to be. People are aware of these things. The lenders are trying to raise interest rates and are able to, that's a very complicated topic, but to cover for inflation. So as we all adjust, maybe we can say that those who benefit and hurt, we may have the two categories, but it's not nearly as extreme. So what's the real problem with inflation?
That fixed income is fine with Social Security, but if you're on your own
retirement
pension plan, if you're living off your own savings, your own insurance, or your union pension plan has X amount of dollars in it, they can't create more.
Yeah. I agree. There are certainly some individuals that are still hurt very much by it. But everybody's trying to find some way to beat the inflation game or to make sure they don't lose as much. So when I try to explain why I think inflation is so dangerous to an economy like ours, which promotes capitalism, I usually give this answer. And now as an economist, I can talk about demand and supply again. Is demand going to be greater than or less than the goods we produce? If we produce at full employment, will we try to buy more goods so the demand is greater than we produce? Or is the demand going to be insufficient to buy what we produce? If the demand is less than supply, we'll end up with a lot of unemployment because we won't buy what we produce. And we'll start laying people off. If the demand is greater than the supply, we end up with inflation. So what happens when inflation sets in to the economy? What does it do to this relationship? Well, on the demand side, I think I mentioned this the other night in the forum. In the demand side, my advice to people is when you earn money, spend it. Don't hold on to it. Spend it before the purchasing power falls. Spend it while it's still worth something. So we have a spend now attitude. To give you an example of how important that is, Carter, 2 years before his re-election bid was to come up, did everything he really could within reason to get people to stop spending. And he couldn't do it because of the inflation. People say, when I get my money, I'm still going to spend it. And if he tried to take it from them, they went out and they borrowed. And so we see we have a desire to borrow if we can't find it or pull it out of any savings we have and spend. So when inflation sets in, and the worse it gets, the greater the desire is to increase the demand. It just starts building on itself. What happens to the supply side? Supply side economics. That's when we talked about Reagan the other day. On the supply side, you must save money. Japan, as I mentioned, saves 30-35%, and their productivity goes up 10% a year. We save 8-10%, and we're having a hard time even getting our productivity up because we don't save money and invest it in new capital. So on the supply side, what happens is savings are low. They're not nearly as high as they should be. And when people do have extra money, they tend to speculate, and they put it into investments that do not produce goods. A house doesn't produce. A piece of land can only produce so much no matter what you pay for it. And gold does not produce anything. And so what we're getting is some difficulty trying to get the supply to increase. Now, maybe the supply doesn't fall. I mentioned it did 3 out of 5 years, and someone made the comment, well, that's the formal market that we see where the supply is falling. In the informal market, they mentioned people are gardening, doing their own work. So that may be part of the transition we're undertaking. I'd like to talk more about that tomorrow. But the supply, if it doesn't fall, at least it's not growing very fast because of this. Whereas the demand is way up. What does that do? Once inflation sets in, it puts continuous pressure. You almost get a snowballing effect in inflation. Spend faster and faster. And the higher the rates go, the less incentive to save, and the greater the desire to spend. Anybody want to make any comments as to whether or not that makes any sense or not before I move on? That tends to be the major problem in a capitalistic country. We don't get the supply to go up, and the demand, we just can't control it. Yes?
I suppose this is really a stupid question, but what are all these people buying?
Yeah.
You're talking about this increased demand, but it seems to me that the demand is for things that people don't need. Mm-hmm. That's.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me say one other thing too. Just because demand goes up, does not mean that they're buying more goods, because the supply side is not responding to that demand, and so the demand is growing faster. And the only thing that can happen if you're not producing more because we're not saving and investing in new capital, it'll pull the prices up even faster. That's where I meant inflation tends to snowball. And what are the people buying? I like to walk through these.
More property.
It's more. Yeah. Well, I walk through these knick-knack shops and look on those shelves, and I just can't believe that people buy those things. But the stores are always open; and they continue to go. So I can't tell you exactly what they're buying. I'm afraid I'm too far removed from the business world, sitting in little Decorah, Iowa, and not being in management. I can't answer that. Somebody else can. You mentioned stereos and. Yes.
I know a lady that has a furniture store with a lot of knickknacks and stuff like that. And she said business has never been better. She's selling a lot of furniture and a lot of knickknacks. Restaurants.
Yeah, restaurants are doing quite well. Of course, you can only produce so much food.
What is the scarcity of goods? I mean, there's an implication that there's not enough goods being produced.
Yeah.
But I don't understand. I know in the public sector what scarcity is in terms of mass transit. Other kinds of goods and services which are in scarce supply in our society, but I don't know where the scarcity is or the lack of production. I mean, the stores are full of goods. There's more fast food restaurants than there's ever been.
Yeah, it's hard for me to answer that except to say that stores always have inventories that they deal with. So, I mean, that could give you the false impression that there are all kinds of goods, but they always work with some inventory. So you'll see the goods sitting there. And I guess I would say that if they're competing in certain markets, if there isn't a scarcity and the supply keeps growing, the prices would come down as they compete with each other because their inventories would build and build and build. If the supply kept coming in and people weren't buying them, either they're going to have to cut back on that supply or they're going to have to lower prices. So I'm that's a theoretical answer to a real world question.
Housing.
Well, there's a scarcity in that people want more than is available. But in economics, we always say that demand doesn't reflect just simply a want. It's also an ability, a willingness and the ability to buy. So that as far as the ability goes, there may not be shortages, because if the abilities are, I know a lot of contractors in Decorah who will go out and build tomorrow. Yes?
I think we have a rather unique facet to this, where many Americans have decided that they're going to buy foreign import cars and have abandoned the American made. That's creating a demand in a different area and definitely a layoff situation in the automobile.
Respond to that, I almost need another session to explain international economics, why we trade, comparative advantage, what the long-run consequences are, and why the automotive industry is really a unique case in this situation. And I think what I would prefer to do, because I want to finish the inflation, is I will make reference to the international sector briefly later on, but that would be a topic that would require a good half hour, and I'd be happy to sit down and visit with you about it. But I think it's related, but it's getting off enough that we would spend an awful lot of time dealing with that issue. Is that fair, or do you think it needs to be handled now and we do another session to finish inflation? I mean, we will run out of time. Yes.
It's related to what I was talking about, because what I see just from reading the newspapers and watching people that I know is not that there is a scarcity of goods of what people really need, what I feel people ought to be buying. What I see an incredible amount of is superfluous things that people don't need, that people are convinced that they should buy, ought to buy, want to buy, by all of the advertising that bombards us constantly.
I happen to agree with you as far as your values are concerned and how you interpret other person's needs and your own needs. I tend to be in the same camp. But the free enterprise system, the beauty of the system, if there's some beauty in the system, is that Nobody tells anybody else what to do. Each individual makes their own decisions. Granted, advertising can be subtle, it's very creative, and it can you try to create wants. But if the goods are there in our system, they're there because somebody's buying them for whatever reason, whether it's a rational decision or not. And if there are shortages of goods, it's only because the people who need those goods are not willing to buy them. Again, it's that willingness and ability. So the free enterprise system works. And your criticism, as I see it, is a criticism of the system, that the system does not meet people's needs, as you define them. But economists would say, if there's really an unwillingness and the ability to buy whatever goods you're referring to as necessities, they would show up. Someone would produce them who could make some money from them. But that willingness evidently isn't there for those who are poor. I mean, the ability to buy them.
It's just like small cars. When we decide we wanted small cars, Japan produced them.
Okay, I'm going to have to make two comments on the international sector. First one is, economists who support the free enterprise system aren't at all worried when dollars go out of the United States. I'll tell you why. If we can send dollars to Japan to buy cars, and they don't take those dollars and turn around and buy goods from us, or from another country, and they get the dollars and buy goods from us, you know what has happened? We have gotten a free lunch. All we did was run the presses, create some paper money, or if not run the presses, do it on the books. And we bought those cars by just saying, here, would you credit the books with so many dollars? And if they sit on them and don't use them, we just got a free lunch. And we did that for about 20 years when we had a system of fixed exchange rates. And that's why we have such a dollar problem today. And now we're talking about international economics, which is the topic, I suspect, maybe for next week. But when the dollars go out, if they don't come back, we have a free lunch. Why would Japan take all those dollars for those cars and say, we're just going to sit on them? Certainly the Japanese can't take those dollars at home and go buy goods. They need their own currency. Can we buy anything with the Japanese yen here? It's not acceptable. Now, the automotive industry is unique in that the U.S. consumer, for whatever reason, maybe it was advertising, maybe it's because we're so rich and affluent and spoiled, gave signals to our automotive dealers that we wanted to buy big cars. And we went through 73, 74, and did not, that's when the OPEC prices quadrupled. And we did not make the shift to smaller cars. So we never sent signals to our automotive industry that we wanted small cars. Then the prices took off again in 78, and all of a sudden we said, we want small cars. Well, you can blame Chrysler for bad management. That's partially true. You can blame Chrysler for not looking into the crystal ball and seeing that it was inevitable. But Chrysler can always come back and say, we produced what you bought. And when you all of a sudden made the transition to smaller cars, and it came pretty fast, we weren't prepared to provide them. The Japanese had the market. They'd been doing it for years. They'd been improving the quality. And so we readily went over and bought their cars. That's something that happened so fast that it has a real effect on our economy, because the automotive industry is what? One out of every six jobs, in some ways, is related to the automotive industry. And so it's kind of a unique case. But that's the claim that they would make. And so they're pleading with us and saying, give us a few years to make the transition and we will be competitive. Please respect us, because we were only producing what you wanted up to 78. Don't blame us because you bought it. All right, I'd like to comment on that a great deal. I won't. But that's the argument that they made. So does that in some ways help on the international setting? Or does that, do you think I am way off?
That, yes? That takes care of kind of a long-range problem with the worker on an assembly line. I think maybe this question, well, I won't say what you're saying, but what does that do for the immediate workers that are laid off? How does
free enterprise system reacts well to changes in demand, whatever, if they're small. We have time to adjust to make the transition. When you get a shock, whether it was the Vietnam War, which created problems, whether it's OPEC prices going up, whether it's the car industry, free enterprise system cannot handle that well at all. There's an enormous amount of suffering. People will be unemployed. They may have to find other jobs in telecommunications, let's say, because we seem to have a comparative advantage there. That transition is going to take time. People are going to suffer in the process. And the one thing that we don't talk about much in capitalism, when we're in the free enterprise system when we're teaching it, is the suffering that does take place during transition periods. I use terms like harmony, equilibrium, demand equals supply. Wait, we're all happy. Yeah, what you're able and willing to buy is going to be there. But when you get the big shock, there is enormous problems. And that, if a free market economist would shudder at the fact that we're bailing out Chrysler. But given the enormous shock that the system has taken, and the enormous suffering of trying to help people who are unemployed or move or get a transition to a new industry, we're getting a lot of pressure to help Chrysler out. And the only reason is because the system can't handle that very well. People suffer in that process. And we would hope it doesn't happen very often, but it does. So there isn't an easy answer as far as I see. And that's, there isn't economists support the Chrysler subsidies. Some economists. And it's for that reason. The problems they see, the costs associated with the automotive industry are far greater than putting on some kind of constraint, preventing your tariff quota, preventing cars from coming in. They figure that cost is less than the transition cost. They try to measure costs and benefits. Well, is that okay? We move on?
No.
One question.
Oh, yes.
Would there be any reason for American industry, would there be an advantage if they perpetuate inflation, the developed trends wants and desires to perpetuate even more inflation. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That just happened to be where I was headed. Perfecto. Nice lead-in.
Call me anytime.
There's something called the Rule of 72. The Rule of 72 says, you're talking about growth rates. If inflation is growing 4% a year, each year the prices are 4% higher, you divide that into 72 and you get every 18 years the prices will double. Inflation goes up to 12%, you divide that into 72, every 6 years the prices will double. This system, as I said, tends to snowball and build on itself. And for any business to say in the long run, having high inflation is good, would be self-defeat, it'd be disaster. You're inviting disaster. The United States has never had problems with high inflation like some of the other countries. Does anybody here come from Germany, Japan, some of those countries? The stories in Germany after during the wars of inflation, they call it hyperinflation, were such that people were paid twice a day, they demanded that. And their families would come twice a day to get the check and actually go to the stores and buy immediately because each day they went down the rolls a couple of times, raising prices. The system becomes inoperable. And so I don't think businesses should invite inflation at all. And I don't think they do. And I think it's that sector that's electing Reagan to some extent because they see the danger of high inflation. It's more the Democratic Party who looks for the poor, after they're supposed to be the spokespeople for the poor, the oppressed, that are saying unemployment is a real problem. Not so much inflation. I mean, they're not saying inflation's good, but they're very concerned about unemployment. But the business sector tends to be very concerned about inflation because you get that snowballing effect, and hyperinflation makes it impossible to run an economy. In fact, in Hungary, World War I, the unit of currency was a pengo. I can't believe this, but I've read it several times. When their hyperinflation reached its peak, let's say one pengo was worth $1. At its peak, one times 10 to the 27 pengos to equal a dollar. Can you imagine writing those bills? You can't operate under those systems. Economy, it collapses. Just a second, Marty.
I hear you saying that inflation is bad for business, but I see them operating as though it were good. For instance, the logging industry in Oregon, when the supply of logs the demand goes down for logs, they'll close down a mill, they'll stop cutting forests, they will ship logs to Japan, and that keeps prices up rather than, and so the prices never came down because instead of having a good supply of logs, they start shipping them off to Japan. you know, so the way they're operating keeps the supply low. They just won't cut their forests.
You are a very good Keynesian economist. Excellent statement. Businesses tend to be quantity adjusters, not price adjusters. And when we get into the question of why is it so difficult to solve inflation, you've hit one of the major problems. We adjust in quantity, we do not lower prices. But businesses, when they are, when they're really, well, businesses tend to operate in the short run, the bottom line being profit. And so the question up here about if there is inflation and they're trying to make profits in the short run, they'll do everything they possibly can to take advantage of the inflation in the short run. And some people say that one of the major problems with the free enterprise system is that we do think in the short run and not the long run often enough. But I think if you ask businesses in the long run, what do you think of inflation? They know it's not going to be good. But given the situation at hand, they're going to do everything they possibly can to make as much money profit, because really in the free enterprise system, that's what we're telling them to do. Be as efficient as possible, to use resources wisely, and your reward will be profits. And so they'll do everything they can in the short run. But I think if you talk to most of them in the long run, I would hope they would just dread inflation. I mean, Germany is so scared of inflation that they will do almost anything to prevent it. And we all say, oh, let's look at Germany as a wonderful example of how you stop inflation. They keep their, well, I haven't even told you the cause of inflation yet, so I guess I'm jumping the gun. But they're able to be tough on inflation because when they get unemployment, they have a lot of people who are not citizens working in the country, and they send them back to the homeland. Well, we cannot do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Switzerland's a good example, too. Okay. Yeah, good questions. Let's move to the next one. Okay. What is the cause of inflation? Now, I'll just put some things on the board here. I probably should say that you talk to different economists, and they'll probably say different things. I hope you realize that I'm just one economist sitting here saying what I happen to think. And you could probably find another economist who had a pretty different point of view. But on the causes here, I would be hard-pressed to think that I'm too terribly far off. I really think that there's some consensus in this area. What causes inflation? What causes prices to rise, the average price level? Anybody want to just... By the way, if you listen to the media, there are all kinds of reasons given. So don't be afraid to shout something out because everybody else is doing it. What have you heard?
Well, one here's an idea from Washington, is government deficit spending.
Okay. There's one, government deficit.
Is that the same as government borrowing?
Right, and what is happening there is, as the government borrows, it competes with the private sector, pushing up interest rates. And an interest rate really is a price. It's the price of borrowing money. And so that has a great effect on anything you do, because one, it is a price, two, you borrow money and you pay higher interest rates, so your cost of whatever it is you're producing goes up just simply because you have to pay higher interest rates. Okay. Yes?
There's an article in Harper's last year that talked about the international banking system and the fact that there's so much money that doesn't really exist that's being spent.
Well, I think the money may exist, but you hit on a good point. The international problem, I wasn't going to deal with that too terribly much today. That's a complex issue. But what's happened is we have dollars all over the world, the euro dollar market, the petrodollar, OPEC countries. And if we think we control our money supply, we're not quite correct, because those dollars can show up in our economy from anywhere, from outside. They're just sitting there. They're not even in the regular flow of the economy. I mean, Saudi Arabia can't spend all the dollars it gets, although it's doing a better job now. Europe has been sitting on the dollars for a long time and saving them, because dollars were good as gold. But yeah, that's a problem. I'll tell you, one reason why it's a problem, too, is that it means that the dollar, the value of the dollar depreciates in the foreign market, which means we have to pay more to buy imports, so that the import price goes up. And if you have to pay more to buy an import, your prices go up. and that leads to inflation.
Yes. That sort of confuses me, though, because I think everybody pretty much has inflation. And what you're talking about there would sound like we'd be having inflation and they'd be having deflation. If the dollar goes down, it has to go down relative to something else, then their money must be going up. Then they wouldn't have inflation.
I need to think through that a little bit, because that you're coming from a different angle than I'm used to, because inflation gets traded around the world. I mean, if our inflation goes down, what happens, or I mean, if our dollar value goes down, we need more dollars to buy the oil. And so what does OPEC say? Well, they want...
A cause has to be a start. And if it starts somewhere and we're getting it, then somebody else has to be losing it. I mean, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I know what you mean. And we're really dealing a lot with international today. It is important, but one of the reasons why the other country isn't losing is because of this dollar, enormous dollar surplus that's built up, and it's just sitting there. And so they're not really losing. They're able to pull from these reserves and use it.
Well, then they're losing from their savings.
Sure, but they've got enormous, the euro dollar market is, it's not quite the size of our total money supply, but isn't too far from it. So, I mean, there's enormous sums in there. But we're doing so much in international right now that I'm getting nervous thinking that this is domestic economic issue. Because I want to say a little bit about the domestic economy in addition to the international. Yes?
I don't know whether this is a result, but like pressure on wage increases, people making wage demands that are really in excess of their productivity.
What this means is, if you produce, let's say you make 10 goods a year, and you get paid $10 for each of those 10 goods, your salary should be $100. If next year, instead of making 10 goods, you make 11, and you're still getting $10 for each good, your salary should go up to $110. But what happens is, you have a powerful union, and you say, we want $120 instead of the $110. So the wage request is greater than the increase in productivity.
Mark, on the same line with respect to the productivity side of it, would what is often termed excessive regulations be a cause, because it would add costs to the production of the goods without increasing the supply of those goods?
Maybe because of the environment, maybe because of health, maybe because of safety factors, I would say all of this relating to the quality of life. We have regulated industry, business, asked them to do more to make their products safe, whatever, protect the environment. And how does this affect the cost of producing a good? And the cost can be, as the cost goes up for producing, you would expect the price of the good to go up to include that higher cost. Okay. That is the one that is so often mentioned.
And then price in excess of worth, to follow that same chain of reasoning.
I'm sorry, I didn't. What did you say?
That forms a line. You have wage increases in excess of productivity, and costs increasing in excess of what's produced, and prices increasing in excess of what they're worth.
And you're all putting the key ingredients in here. We're building this just very nicely. You haven't forgotten many things. I'll try and put this together in some framework to show what you're talking about. Mark?
I've always heard that one of the big causes of inflation was that we have nearly reached our limit in terms of productivity. That, for instance, in case the American worker 500 hours to produce an automobile. Well, it takes anybody else anywhere in the world 1,000 hours, even in Japan. Nobody's close to our productivity. And because we cannot increase the productivity of the American worker, we get inflation.
I haven't heard any figures on the American worker, but I know our productivity is behind many other countries, like in steel, for example, and other industries. It may be in some industries we have. I think the argument you're trying to make, though, in economics we talk about the law of diminishing returns. It says that if you have one farm, 10 acres, and you want to increase your yield, what you're producing, the output, you start adding water and fertilizer, whatever, in workers. Well, when you add the first unit of each, your output goes up to, say, 40 bushels. Then you add, and let's make it lower, 30 bushels. You add the next unit, and it goes from 30 bushels up to 70. It increased by 40. My numbers aren't good. Let's start with 20 on the first one. 20. You add another one, it goes up by 30. Goes up to 50. You add another unit of all those, and it goes from 20 to 50. Now we go up by 40. We go up to 90. Each time we have an increasing return. The first unit brought us 20 units. The second increase of those units brought us an additional 30. Then third increase brought us an additional 40. That's called increasing returns. But at some point, diminishing returns set in. So now you add the fourth unit of all of those, and it goes from 90 to 120. It only went up 30. The last one was 40. Now, that's a law that I don't know of anybody who's found an exception to it. Because if that didn't hold, you could take a flower pot. This is economists love to say this. You could take a flower pot and feed the whole world. Just keep adding fertilizer and water. So, some would apply that concept to technology and knowledge. And it's becoming more and more difficult to increase output with the same number of inputs. And that's debatable. The last 20, 25 years show that trend to be true. But as I've heard about some of the new technologies that they're working with, I'm not so sure it's true. Malthus said it was, but technology can overcome the law of diminishing returns, is what I'm really saying.
Well, yes, so
postpone it.
Yes, so okay. You shift. You shift to a different set.
Right. Yeah.
Does technology overcome the law of diminishing returns?
Well, you're right. The law of diminishing returns always holds. It's I'm thinking in terms of graphs, and I'm not drawing them. But yeah, it doesn't overcome it. It still holds. It's just that the technology enables everything to move up a few units, and you still have that sort of a, it rises and falls. It's just now we're up here, it's rising and falling.
Well, it's still extracted in some other sphere. In the environment, or you can get that flower pot to produce more and more, but the fertilizer is coming from somewhere.
Yeah, that's a good point. The materials balance. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does speculation cause inflation? For example, in houses, people buying houses because they think they're going to be worth like gold.
That was the result of inflation.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to fit that in the scheme. I'd have to think through that one for a while. I can't just. I mean, we said earlier, yes, that it contributes, but in the framework I'm using, I'm not really sure where to fit it in. I'd have to think about it rather than gamble. Trying to answer that.
Would scarce resources, difficulty utilizing your resources?
Mundane resources.
I wouldn't put it on here. Somebody told me to read the last Newsweek issue. They said there's a very good article in there on military spending, and I think how it affects the economy. And as I mentioned in earlier sessions, I have to apologize for not knowing a great deal about the ramifications, consequences of that. I'll put it.
My colleague from Spencerstown on that issue says he knows of no major study on military spending that did not show that it was inflationary. There aren't a lot of them, but he knows none of them. Don't show that.
In Israel?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, let me. I've got some figures here just to make you feel a little bit better. Switzerland in the last 5 years has had 12% inflation. Divide 5 into 12. West Germany, 22%. But they're hardliners. Remember, they don't want inflation. They'll tolerate high unemployment or whatever. Austria, 29%. Now, Japan, 37%. Norway, 49%. Canada, 52%. U.S., 53%. There aren't too many below us. Sweden, 65%, France, 64%, Great Britain, 95%, Greece and Italy, 112%, 115%, and then you can go to Argentina, Turkey, Chile, and push it up around 5, 6, 7, 800. But let me try and put this into a common framework that we can deal with. In some ways, it may look like I'm avoiding the issue when I start this, but there's only one cause of inflation. It's an increase in the money supply. And what we have to do is figure out why the money supply increases. The only way prices can go up is if you put more money into the economy. So I'll give you an equation, a Milton Friedman equation. It's like this, M with a superscript S, which stands for money supply. You take that times velocity. Velocity is the number of times each dollar is spent in a year. So if I get the dollar, because I'm paid for my work, and then I spend that in an industry, that's the one flow through the economy, to the worker, to the factory production, then to buy a good and service. That's one. Then when that industry pays somebody, they get it, and then they buy something, that's a velocity of two. Our velocity is running between 5 and 6. I'll put on here velocity of 5. Each dollar we have, anybody know what money is? Just out of curiosity. It's currency, coins and paper money, and checking accounts, demand deposits, just so we know what we mean by money. This is equal to the price, average price for the country, average price level, times Q, output, the number of units of physical goods and services we produce. This is the real side, that's what we're producing, gross national product, goods and services. This is the money side. We assume that the velocity is constant, that it doesn't change much. If you want to take a graduate course in this, you can argue about that for 2 months. The quantity, we also assume, will be fairly fixed for this reason. We want full employment. The United States is very concerned about that. And if you maintain full employment, then the output will stay pretty much fixed at a certain level. There's only one way you can get prices to go up in this system, and that's to put more money into it. And so let's say that we're producing 100 units here, and we're doing it at a price of $10 per unit. That's $1,000. How much money do we need in this system to carry out that production in the real world? You want
200.
Okay, 200. If we have $200, each dollar gets used 5 times, we now have $1,000 to buy those goods we just produced. The average price being $10 and the quantity $100. The only way you will get this price to go up, I'll put a term over here, the only way you'll get permanent, that's sustained, permanent, it's going to stay with us, inflation, is if you increase the money supply. And you look at the record in the United States, if our inflation is 10%, look at how the money supply increased, 9, 10, 11%, maybe 12%, because some of the increases due to productivity. Over the year, quantity goes up just a little bit. Very close correlation. The question is, why does the money supply go up? One of the major reasons is the government may go out and borrow money. And they'll borrow money, and how can you spend more than you take in? You have to borrow. The government has the right to print money, but the United States government does not do that. What it does is borrow from the Federal Reserves, banks, from you, whatever, and that increases the money in circulation. If it borrows some of your savings, or if it borrows from the Federal Reserve, they'll just write, we'll give you so much money, put it on paper, and give it to the federal government. Most of what we do is all on paper. By the way, I don't want to scare you too much, but you know these, what are those initials that say you have $100,000 in the bank and you're safe? It's just a really a farce. We don't have nearly enough money to back up everybody's. For a couple banks, no problem. But if we all went to the bank tomorrow and asked for our money, there's only about $1 backing every $6, $7. And then they can, I mean, it makes you feel good though when you read it.
You're referring to the actual backup money on
right.
hand.
On hand, right. But what we do is, well, we expand the money supply by making loans.
Yeah.
And it's on paper, it's a loan. It says, okay, we'll give you money. And it works many, many times.
Like,
I probably shouldn't have raised that, because now we have to talk about monetary policy. And that's okay, there's one cause in a permanent inflation. What would cause this to go up? It might be the government's trying to spend too much money. The key is that the demand, aggregate demand, oh, I didn't want to use that term, total demand in the nation is growing. Why would it grow? Consumers may try to spend more and spend faster. Businesses might try to spend more and faster, which means some borrowing. Government may try to spend more than they're taking in. And with the rest of the world, in short term, it's possible we'll get an imbalance. But it's people trying to spend too much. Too much money chasing too few goods. The demand's greater than the supply. When that happens, we get inflation. That's the only cause of inflation. Now, I'm going to give you a second cause of inflation. Now, this is too much demand, too much money. This is what I call temporary inflation. And I think that this whole issue is very confused in the media, because you'll hear these kinds of issues. I'm going to assume that the money supply, the velocity, and the quantity are all fixed. Okay, we're not going to increase the money supply. Velocity's fixed, and we're at full employment. We have a certain level of output. Are you with me? Okay. Now, I'm going to give you several reasons as to why we end up with some real problems. They're the reasons you gave earlier. One, scarce resources. If you want to go out and get a resource, a raw material, we used to just go out and dig a well. It wasn't much work. You try to go and find some oil today, and you know what it costs to get that oil? You go off in the continental shelves, wherever. It just costs more to get resources. And when the cost of these scarce resources go up, and you can include in there oil or food, it becomes more expensive to produce food, this is going to cause the cost of production, the cost of producing the good, to increase. A second example, government regulation. As I mentioned, that's really for quality of life, environmental concerns, safety, health. You put these new regulations on firms, and they've got to do things to ensure that they don't harm the environment, put in extra safety factors, and that's going to cause the cost of their product to go up. So once again, the cost of producing the good goes up. Then we'll put in here labor unions. I used to just be furious with George Meany when he'd say to the government, we have unemployment. When is the government going to come in and help the workers? One of the reasons they had unemployment was because George Meany and his unions, at times, not always, but at times, were able to push their wages up faster than their productivity went up. Unjustified. In economics, you would never let that happen. But when did it start? Vietnam War. Unemployment below 4%. We had to produce for the war and at home. The demand was there. You couldn't find workers if they wouldn't work. They took advantage of that situation. And in the period around the Vietnam War in the early 70s, I think they increased their wages almost 70-80%, and their productivity went up 10-12%. Part of that was cost of living, but that doesn't account for that enormous gap. Another one, imports from foreign countries. The dollar is lagging, the dollar is declining, so you have to pay more dollars buy those same inputs. There's a couple other arguments that are fairly complicated. I think I'll leave those out. But what is happening here is that all of these are pushing the costs of production up. Milton Friedman, Paul Heen, I think, who comes here often, would say that a lot of that's because the demand is high. But still, the costs of production are going up. What is that going to do to this equation? Oops. Excuse me. I want to back up a second here. I don't want to hold that fixed. Sorry. I got the bind there. We'll just hold the left side fixed. We're not going to raise the money supply now. What's going to happen to that equation? Does the costs go up? The businesses will take those higher costs and charge higher prices. And that's legitimate. Nothing wrong with that, according to good economic theory, at least. The prices go up. What's the consequence of rising prices if you don't put more money in the economy to cover that increase in prices? This has to fall. And when the output you produce falls, you get some unemployment. You don't produce as much. You lay people off. Unemployment goes up. Economists will say, and this really irritates me. A lot of economists will say there's only one cause of inflation. The prices or money supply is increasing. They will say, it isn't because of OPEC scarce resources. It isn't because of unions. It isn't because of government regulation. Those are not good reasons. Well, they're right in this to this extent. This will not cause permanent inflation. It will cause temporary inflation. The price will go up and the output will fall. But if we wait and we don't do anything with the money supply, what's going to happen if we wait long enough? And we may have to wait a long, long time because of the way we operate and think in our economy. But what would happen is unemployment fell, or unemployment rose because output falls. All of a sudden you run out of unemployment compensation. All of a sudden, what will eventually happen? Someone's going to start saying, all right, we'll take lower wages just to get the job. And someone may lower their costs somewhat just so they can supply the goods because their costs have gone up, but not as many people are buying those. And they say if you wait long enough, you'll get this one to turn around. Slowly the output will come back up as people will accept lower prices and lower wages, and that will cause this to fall back down. They say it's only temporary. You follow that? If you wait for a while, this, see, you can't have high prices and maintain full employment unless you put more money in the economy. And if you don't put it in, that's only a temporary cost. And so they say that's not a real cause of inflation. The only cause is we get unemployment. I like this supposition. you get unemployment, and what happens? We have the Employment Act of 46 that says the government must worry about employment. You have political pressure during election years. You get a lot of pressure from unions who are having unemployment and from others. And so what is the government forced to do? Raise the money supply. So what do? We don't tolerate this in our system. And Keynesian economics says that you have unemployment compensation for a while, so you don't worry too much about lowering your wages. And as you mentioned, Mr. Keynes, we're quantity adjusters. We lower quantity, we don't lower prices. If anything, we let them go up. Because of that, we see this happening, and we won't take it for long. Unemployment goes up to 6, 7, 8%. We get nervous. And so we come in, we break that rule, and we raise the money supply. Now we have permanent inflation. And why? Because we raise the money supply. So if you ever hear an economist say, the only reason you have inflation is because the money supply is going up, people are spending too fast, that, I think that's a little misleading. Because all of these can contribute to it, but in an indirect way. They don't have to, but the way we think and operate in our system, they will lead to an increase in the money supply, and now we have inflation. Okay, yeah.
You call these temporary causes, and you say that eventually the system would re-equilibrate. But what if these become permanent factors? What if resources are becoming scarcer and scarcer, obviously. Government regulations are becoming more and more voluminous. Labor unions are becoming more and more demanding. The foreign markets becoming bigger and bigger. If these factors become permanent, even though they're temporary factors, doesn't inflation become permanent?
I'm not so sure they become permanent, because as unemployment goes up and we're starting to lower prices, I think unions just wouldn't get by with it. I just don't think they could do it, because prices were falling, people were unemployed. I think they would feel the pressure of not, I mean, I just don't see how people would give in. On government regulations, I mean, already aren't we saying we don't need as many safety factors in cars because we know it's a little inflationary, or it becomes inflationary.
Well, so what if we don't?
Well, if we don't do that, then we are going to have, well, when we look at solutions, I see two options. One is an enormous amount of unemployment where the sacrifices are very unjust. I mean, who suffers in unemployment? The executives, the people at the top, the people with seniority? No. And it's the people who can be laid off first. And so if we don't, and we continue to think the way we do, the suffering is going to be borne by those who probably can least afford it. If we could go to something like maybe a simpler lifestyle and say, why should we, and see, the queue is falling, that's what you're saying. Why don't we all work a 32-hour week? And I'll share in this. We'll all have a little lower income, but we'll respect scarcity. And we'll respect the quality of life. That's another option. That's voluntary. The other one is full steam ahead and let some suffer more than others. Yes, Ben.
Last night in the paper, it was telling about the waitresses and the hotel people in Seattle going on strike.
Mm-hmm.
They were asking people to empathize with them and to keep stay away because when they were off, they were having a big problem that about 10 people were hungry for a job and were willing to work for less. So that would be an example of what you're saying, right?
There are a few signs right now in the economy that say that Reagan may get some assistance in fighting inflation. That's one, the one you just mentioned. There seems to be a little more willingness to accept a lower wage now. You hear firms that say, we will accept lower wages or no increase just so we can all stay employed. That's happening. You mentioned one where people will come in and work for a lower wage. Another is OPEC. OPEC has said we're going to hold the prices at $32 a barrel. But look what's happening to our inflation. When we buy that oil now with our dollars that are depreciating, we're really gaining, you see. I mean, we're using dollars that don't buy as much. And OPEC said they're willing to do that for a while at least. So there are a few things that are going to happen that are going to help Reagan. OPEC won't do that for long now. although that's OPEC's an interesting situation because of the internal conflicts that are going on there right now.
We're doing that.
Doing what?
Helping their internal conflicts.
Oh, well,
no, I was just so surprised that, you know, it seemed like OPEC had it all, and now they're just...
Okay, I'll tell you what the internal conflict is as I see it. Saudi Arabia has an enormous amount of oil. The Soviet Union, I think, is one, Saudi Arabia two, or three. And they know if they push the price up too fast, we will move to substitutes. And they have a long supply. So they don't want the prices to go up too fast, because then the West or the North might say, hey, we better switch, and they lose their market. The little countries, the other 12, Iran and Iraq are big too, but the other countries say, we don't have much time left, and we're going to milk the North for all we can get. Well, Saudi Arabia says that's against our interest. The others say it's in our interest, but Saudi Arabia is so big and powerful in the OPEC group that they say, you try it, and we'll flood the market. And they're already up to 12 whatever billion. I mean, they're not flooding the market in the terms of flooding, but it's certainly up. And they've been able to draw the line there. That's the internal conflict. And so it may go for a while. I don't think there's any doubt. Well, I mean, I don't think we would manipulate the internal breakdown. My goodness, you know how our oil companies are benefiting from OPEC. That would be in their best interest, too, to see the prices go up somewhat. Not too fast, though. That's true, though. We don't want them to go up too fast, because you have to wait until solar and that is marketable. Yes?
I don't understand why the velocity is fixed. No. Because it seems to me that if prices increased and people were unemployed, people would be buying less, and so that there wouldn't be as much of a turnover.
The problem, I think, is that when people are unemployed, they still have unemployment compensation, they still live on savings and retirement programs, so that change in velocity wouldn't be as great as you think it would be. And we're only talking about, I don't mean only in that 2 million people isn't very many, but if unemployment is, probably full employment is about 5%, 5.5%. And I really believe that. I don't think that the free enterprise system today can do much better than 5.5% unemployment. That's, I guess, another topic. So our unemployment today is 2%. Still over 2 million people, and they still have access to some funds. So that, but I have.
And on your one up there, why it doesn't increase when there's more money and people and there's more demand? Why, and if people are buying faster and faster, why doesn't your velocity increase?
Okay, you've raised some real. You know, those are good points. Thanks for raising them. In the past, we assumed that velocity was very constant. There's a lot of debate going on today. In fact, one of the causes of inflation, some say, not very many, is that the velocity is picking up. And I can give you an excellent example. In 78, when Carter tried to tighten the money supply up and tighten demand, it didn't backfire, it just didn't work, because we went out and we spent faster. And the velocity did go up. So that can happen. But I think that contribution is not always there to inflation. It's a possibility, it has happened. But the money supply far outweighs the changes in velocity. But it isn't so constant that you don't see any variation. The two questions I wanted to raise next. Why does it appear that unemployment and inflation are both increasing? Do they increase simultaneously? In other words, do they both go up together? Or what's wrong? I mean, why are they going up? Does one go up and one down? Or, but economists would say, I'll just give you a little exercise here. If the demand's increasing real fast, faster than the supply, what do you get?
Inflation.
The demand's increasing too fast. But then if you pull the demand way back, in our system, what usually happens when the demand falls? King said we're quantity adjusters, not price adjusters. You don't lower prices. Why? That's terrible psychology. To get consumers used to falling prices, and pretty soon they don't buy until they fall. That's risky. I mean, think about it. All of a sudden, you see them falling. Oh, just buy. Then they start going, well, I wouldn't sit back and wait till they fall next time. You can't start that. The second thing is, you know the government will bail everybody out and pour the money into the economy when the unemployment goes up. So why drop prices? Just wait for the government to bail us all out. That's Keynesian economics. And the third one is, you can always say, maybe it's a temporary drop in demand. And we better wait for a while to see if it really is real. And there's some truth to that. Maybe in a few months it'll be right back up. So why should we drop prices for a couple months when we're going right back up? So there's a real reluctance to be price adjusters. So the demand goes up faster than the supply, we get inflation. When the demand comes down, we pull the demand down, what do we get? Unemployment. Economists say there's a trade-off. They always have. Inflation, when it's worse, unemployment's better. When inflation starts to fall, if it does at all, or if you stop the growth, unemployment goes up. Well, how can both increase if there's a trade-off? What has happened? And also, if we think we know economics, why can't we solve it?
We're being humbled.
Well,
let's see what happens. Maybe that's not so wild an idea. Maybe we just don't know it all.
Oh, I hate to say it, but it's kind of complicated, kind of complex. Okay. I'm going to use a graph. And on this axis, I'm going to put the percent unemployment. And on the vertical axis, I'll put the percent inflation. I'll just put it here. I'm going to really be a dreamer for a second. So put in some kind of a target. I'm going to say the target is that we have about 3-4% inflation and 5% unemployment.
They've returned.
Well, you know, but we are so well.
Okay. Let's say this is the target. What we have, I said, is a trade-off. It looks something like this. As the demand goes up, this is Keynesian economics now, controlling demand, controlling the spending. As the demand goes up, we move in this direction along that curve, the trade-off. As the demand falls, we tend to move in this direction. Now, notice that in this area here, we find that we just move along that curve. And you'll find from mid-1950s to about 1965, that's all we did. We moved up and down the curve, and the points were here, the points were there each year. We said we had something called the Phillips curve, this trade-off. But then all of a sudden, something strange happened. We got into the Vietnam War, and for the first time ever, the inflation went above. By the way, until 1967, I don't think we ever had a year over 2% inflation, or 2.8% inflation. It was 0.5%, 1%, 2%, back to 1%. That's where we were. And when I bought chocolate candy bars, they were a nickel until I got into college. I mean, I went 20-some years with a nickel candy bar, a dime pop, and 60-cent movie, whatever. All of a sudden, the Vietnam War sets in, and the demand goes up. the money supply goes up. To finance the war, the unions want more, they put pressure on. They've got the pressure because we don't have any other workers. And in a very short period of time, at the end of the 60s, we went up to 6% inflation. I think I made my graph too small, but we're 16. We're up to 6% inflation. Notice that when you get beyond this range, you don't get unemployment to fall much. Maybe I'm a little unfair here. There we go. But unemployment doesn't fall much because you can't get unemployment down much more. There are always people who voluntarily quit a job, look for a new one. There are always people who will be laid off as the demand shifts back and forth. There are people who will enter the market for the first time or re-enter. You've got structural unemployment because of discrimination or technological problems. And so it's hard to get it below there. So most of that increase was inflation. Yes?
Just a quick one. Are people on strike counted in the unemployment figures?
Let's say,
for example, Colmar.
I can't answer that.
Are they counted in unemployment figures?
I've always thought that the people, the way we define unemployment is people who are actively seeking work at a fair wage rate and cannot find it. So if you look at the coal miner and say, well, they're asking a fair wage rate and they're not getting to work, maybe they are unemployed. If someone says that's not a very fair wage rate, then they're voluntarily not working. And so I don't know how that would
happen. How does the government figure it?
No, I just say I don't know. I don't know in that particular case. Well, anyway, we get to this point and panic sets in. We've been living with 2% inflation, no higher, for 15, 20 years. And all of a sudden we have 6%. I just remember what is when we were in economics in those days.
Yeah.
That was terrible. And so what do? Panic sets in. The Federal Reserve goes, gee, we increased the money supply about 6-8% at that time. We can't do this. And you get pressure from the business sector, from everybody, too much inflation. And our Federal Reserve is interesting. I mean, they go way overboard, increasing the money supply, and then they go, oh, I think we made a mistake. And they panic. And at this point, they cut the growth of the money supply. They brought it back to 0%. What did that do to the people? We used to say, well, you stop the demand, you come back down the curve. But now something has happened. Inflation psychology is beginning to set in. Down here at 1-2%, who even paid any attention to the 1-2%? At 6%, you say, hey, last year prices went up 6%. I'm not going to ask for a 0% increase in my wages when it went up 6% last year. If it was 1%, who's going to bicker over 1% or whatever? You're sort of lulled to sleep. You don't pay any attention to it. In fact, I don't even know if we talked about inflation in those days. It's always unemployment. You're not producing at full capacity in all of this. Well, we come back on a different path. We slam the brakes on. Well, by the way, this is called stock goal policy. We're going at great guns here. That was literally, I guess, the Vietnam War. And we stop. What happens? We don't come back down the curve. We head in this direction. And for very short periods of time, usually never more than 6 months, we get an increase in inflation. Notice this point is higher than this point on this axis. And we get an increase in unemployment. We usually call this inflationary recession. It occurs for very short periods of time. I call this period in here acceleration. Now, what has happened is, can any of you tell me what's happening to the money supply right now? It takes a long time to find out that the money supply got tightened, and there's a time lag in there. So because of inflationary expectations, or because of old contracts, this inflation continues. Now, finally, people are aware we've got a problem. The money supply is tightened up. And then we go on to phase three. The money supply stays tight. It's just that inflationary psychology starts to erode because you know the money supply is not increasing. And you know that unemployment is going up. And we start coming down in this direction. So like this. At first it's very flat and then it gets steep. And if you're really lucky, you pull it back in like this. I mean, we've never been there before, except under Gerald Ford for 1 year. But that's a possibility. Okay, I don't know what to do about time because I really need okay, I suppose I could finish this in 2 or 3 minutes by just drawing and talking fast. When you come down, a couple things happen. You're very impatient because this can take years. This one might have taken 6-8 months. It can take years to come down. Switzerland and Japan have shown us that it takes about a year to get rid of 1.5% of inflation. Why? It's built in. It gets built into the system. And you think I'm going to take a 0% increase next year in wages when the prices are still going up at 6, 5.5%? You know, you're crazy. It's too built in. But then what happens? This becomes a political game. Election year. High unemployment. You can't get elected on high unemployment in this country. And so, part of it's the election year. Another problem was OPEC came along. OPEC, oh, there's an enormous number of things that happened. And instead of coming all the way back down here, we get this far and we take off again. And what has happened? We're on the fourth spiral now. And each time we spiral, we're working in a northeast direction and they're both going up. There's only short periods of time where they go up together. But the problem is we never come all the way back down. We're not patient. Too much political pressure. Too much pressure from OPEC. And that puts pressure on money supply. We take off again and then, holy cow, we got 8-10%. Federal Reserve says, 8-10%? That's embarrassing. We slam the brakes on. We come back down. We think we're all ready. And then Carter came in. And Carter says, unemployment is a problem. So is inflation. And we go again. Well, we were up at 18 temporarily. And we can't have this.
So, Mark, is supply side economics as significant as a shock to break inflation psychology as it is in terms of its whatever the aspects of this, whether or not it'll work? I mean, is it something required to break the psychology, and the old economics simply wasn't doing it?
Okay.
And supply side is an alternative.
Yeah. Okay. I really appreciate the fact that some of you are still here. I'm going to read five solutions. Just read them real fast, and two of them are the ones you mentioned.
Okay.
The first is to continue Keynesian economics. Cut back on the demand and the money supply, and just let this thing come back down. It'll be long, it'll be slow, it'll be relatively painful. It's going to cause, I don't know if any politician could live through it, because you probably wouldn't get reelected, but that's an option. Let's just go each year, try to bring out 1-1.5%. A second option is supply side economics. If you can't control the demand, hit that supply side for all you're worth and let that take care of the problem, because it's so hard to bring the demand down. And if you just put more goods out there, that can bring the price down because you flood the market with goods. Now, the big question in Reagan economics is, can it work when you have inflation? If you go back to the beginning, what do you do when you get money? More money when inflation's high, it tends to create more inflation rather than help the supply side. A second example on the supply side, I really like this answer. As an economist, I don't believe in wage and salary controls at all. But some say when you're at this point, what you do, or you're at this point, you say next year wages and salaries will be the same as they were last year. Wages and salaries make up about 75% of costs. And you just tell everybody you're getting zero next year, and then you see no one saying. I'm afraid that if I sacrifice and don't take a raise, and everybody else does, in a relative sense, I'm behind. You pass a law that says, that's part of a shock, Larry, by the way. You just say nobody gets it. And that's to break it and bring us back down here. That's an option that a lot of people are talking about. A third one, I love this one. Drastic cut in the money supply. Cut it by 25%. There are some people who are talking about that, and some good economists. They say that'll shock us out of it. However, in the process, unemployment for half a year could hit 25%. They estimate a third of the banks will go bankrupt. But they're saying, it's going to be painful no matter what we do. Let's just make it a real short time period. And then we don't have to suffer as long. Okay. Then a fourth solution is the benevolent authoritative government dictator that comes in and says, we're going to just plan the economy. We will set the prices. But history shows that central planning is very inefficient and has not worked. But there are a lot of people talking about it. And the last one is, and this is the one that I tend to be a little interested in, and that is, I lost my chalk. Well, anyway, when that quantity falls and the price goes up, that's when, if you leave the money supply fixed, and the price goes up and the quantity falls, maybe what we ought to do is think of simpler lifestyles. Mm-hmm. This all sacrifice, it's a voluntary solution. Probably not high hopes. But let's all cut back a little bit. Work a few less hours. Buy fewer things. Cut back on demand. And as I think John Schramm may have said, that might be a very freeing experience. If we consume less, conserve more, and share. Oh, I have one last thing. As a Christian responsibility, I think throughout all of this, stewardship is extremely important. Because we do have scarcity. We do have problems with the quality of life and the environment. I think you have to look at the stewardship angle here if you're going to have any respect for this. In other words, supply-side economics to me is not stewardship. Another is living simpler. That's not easier, but that may be an alternative that at least some people need to be exploring. And then I have to bring in this whole idea of a global perspective. To think that we're going to solve our inflationary problems and unemployment problems by producing more and more and more, I think promises very little in the long run, because it's going to mean that the north-south gap will grow and we're just inviting trouble down the road. So, thanks for listening.